Actually, thank you to Wendy for hosting it. Completely excellent. On the Upper West Side. And before Rebony Hankin begins, I just wanted to point out two things which are upcoming, which are kind of fun. One is our annual Nishmat brunch at Sotheby's, which is going to take place next month, in December. And I'll sort of pass these around for people that haven't seen them. They're on the table. Everybody here should have received one at home, but we brought a few extra just in case. And it's always a lot of fun. We have the place to ourselves. It's the only time where you get private tours by the various people in charge, Jennifer Roth in Fine Arts and John Ward in Silver and Rivka Sacker in Paintings and I guess myself in Books and Manuscripts. And we look forward to having all of you join us. I know sometimes it coincides with close to the winter vacation, and we're happy this year it's early and that everyone will come. And also, I see that we have these wonderful cards, which I'm just seeing, about Nishmat Summer Institute 2014, and July 3rd to July 24th. It's never too early to begin thinking about summer, especially as the weather is finally turning cold. Definitely thinking about summer. So with that in mind, Rebony Hankin, take it away.
Is there a theme yet? What? Have you come up with a theme yet?
No. We're open to suggestions.
Bokeh tov to everyone. Thank you so much, Wendy, for hosting us this morning. And thank you, Sharon, for the introduction. I think we're an intimate enough group that we should go around. There are some new faces here, and there are quite a number of recidivists. So why don't we go around one time and start with Chevy and just everyone introduce herself for the sake of the new participants, and then we'll start. Chevy, you're first with the introduction.
I'm Chevy, and I work for American Friends of Mishmash.
Chevy Becker.
Chevy makes the dynamics possible.
Oh, I'm sorry. He has in mind.
Yeah. I'm Rita Lepinski, and this is my first time here, so it's me.
You'll be sorry what you missed.
I'm Robin Cesarski, and I'm sitting back here with Violet, and she doesn't bother anybody.
She's an angel.
Exactly.
No Violet.
Sue Javitt.
Nikki Kent.
Hannah Rudolph.
Erin Kaufman.
Marilyn Levine.
Claire Dean Stack.
Bobby Hahn.
Sharon Mintz.
Wendy Greenbaum. Okay. Let me start with a little bit of a review, and kudos to Irene and to Nikki, who forced part two of this presentation. Last month, I felt after the funeral in Yerushalayim of Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, according to the media, between 700,000 and more people who were there, that one needed to look at his life's work. One needed to look at his derech b'halacha, his halachic heritage, and I don't know what's going to become of his halachic heritage. You know, for so many people, Rabbi Yosef's halachic heritage was colored or clouded by his political activity. So now that the political activity, now that the figure is separate from the political activity, I think there's a tremendous amount in his halachic heritage, which I hope will be impactful upon generations to come. I tried last time to give a little bit of biography together with reading some of his tshuvot. Let me recap very, very quickly his biography, take us back to one of his tshuvot, and then go on to read in detail two other tshuvot. I mentioned last time Rabbi Yosef was born in 1920. He wasn't born in Israel, he was born in Baghdad. He came to Israel at age 3. His family was not a rabbinic family. The morning after he passed away, I was listening to the radio on my way to Nishmat, and the morning radio and host compared Rabbi Yosef to a combination of Google, Wikipedia, and Waze. I mentioned this last time. And you'll see here his memory was encyclopedic, the kind of thing that you get, once in a millennium or so. There was a grasp of the corpus of Jewish scholarship that you just don't see. His path was very interesting. He, as a Sephardi, studied in Sephardi institutions. His father wanted him to leave the yeshiva very early on, and the Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Addis, came to visit the father, who was a grocer. He had been a metal smith in Baghdad. Rabbi Addis came and said, leave him in the yeshiva, I'll come work for you in the grocery. Rabbi Yosef was so fast that he had no chavruta. And when you look at today's tshuva, the tshuvot that we're going to read, I wonder, and perhaps you will also, whether the kind of independence that he had was fostered by the fact that he didn't study in any context. I mean, there he was in Sephardi yeshiva, but he was an autodidact. He devoured everything. Nobody could keep up with him, so there was no chavruta. There were people that he spoke to. He would walk home from the old city with Rabbi Ben Sion Abba Shaul every day, and then eventually from Geula. They couldn't afford a bus. And they would talk together. And Rabbi Ben Sion Abba Shaul became Rosh Yeshiva. Shalom, shalom. Is there another copy of the sources somewhere? There should be several. Okay. I'm doing a recap of last time, and then we'll get into this time. Rabbi Ben Sion Abba Shaul became Rosh Yeshiva of Parat Yosef, but nobody could keep up with Rabbi Yosef. Now, I mentioned last time, forgive me for this recap, but I need to bring us all together to where we're going to start. When he was 17 years old, Rabbi Addis sent him out to give a shiur in the Bukharim. Do you remember that I mentioned this last time? And I mentioned that the shiur was between Mincha and Ma'ariv, and the subject, in all of this Fardi Minyanim, to keep people in shul between Mincha and Ma'ariv, when everyone is tired, they would learn Ben Ish Chai, and basically what they would do is hear the Divrei Torah and the Parsha and learn a halacha and two, and that would be fine. And I mentioned last time that Rabbi Yosef, we read a tshuva in which he describes how he would prepare for the shiur, and he described, so I read through the Ben Ish Chai. But he didn't just read through the Ben Ish Chai. What he did is he read through the Ben Ish Chai, and then he compared it with the sources of the Ben Ish Chai. Now the Ben Ish Chai was a big machmir, and he was almost universally accepted by the Sfardim. He passed away about 50 years before Rav Ovadia was born. So his period of activity was the 19th century. And he was very much influenced by the Ashkenazi. You know, what's the common word? When you get to davening, the Sephardim sing or chant and the Ashkenazim cry. I was reading a tshuva a few days ago of Rav Ovadia Yosef, in which he was talking about Simcha and Rosh Hashanah. Now, to an Ashkenazi, rejoicing on Rosh Hashanah is taboo. On Rosh Hashanah, you're aware of the fact that you're going before the heavenly court with fear and trembling. And Rav Ovadia brings, you've got to be happy on Rosh Hashanah. There's a mitzvah of Simcha on Rosh Hashanah. In any event, the Ben Ish Chai became very much accepted, both because of his great piety, because of his, he was remarkably, what's the word in English? His literary output was enormous.
Prolific.
No one up from Israel. And he was very much accepted. So Rav Ovadia gave to the shul in the Bruch Harim, and he would read a line saying, and the Ben Ish Chai says this, and it's wrong. And the Ben Ish Chai says that, and we don't hold that way. And the Ben Ish Chai says this, and that's not what we do. And very soon, people were thronging to Rabbi Yadis and saying, what have you sent us? And Rabbi Yadis himself came down to the shul in the Bruch Harim and said, remember, he's 17 years old. That's like a senior in high school who's there, La Briut. A senior in high school who's telling everyone that which they thought was dogma, and this is wrong, and that's wrong, and that's wrong. How do you get someone who's that way? You know, you can do a psychological study of character, and on top of that, you can say that you have a person who is basically an autodidact, and he's been through Shas, he's been through the Rishonim, he's been through the sources of the Shulchan Aruch, and he has come to the conclusion that the Shulchan Aruch is right. Now, the Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Karo, was a great Meikil. He was lenient in his rulings, as distinct from the Ashkenazim. If there are any Ashkenazim present, they can be duly chastised at this point. The Ashkenazim are machmir in everything, and the Sfardim are not. And so Rabbi Yosef, and there was a particular concern of his, it's not that you can be machmir and there's no cost to it. You know, the Ashkenazim, and especially the Haredim, are always interested in the point of the pyramid. You have a yeshiva and it can have 500 people, 498 of them are not important. The two who are going to reach the stature of being greats in Jewish law, those are the people who are important. And the Sfardim will never look at things that way. The Sfardim will always look at the people and the cost of not including the people. So Rabbi Yosef was saying, and Ben Ish Chai says this, and he's wrong, and Ben Ish Chai says, not he's wrong, and we don't hold that way, we don't rule that way. Maybe he also said he's wrong. And in a tshuva that we read last month, he said, the Ben Ish Chai ruled stringently, chastain milei, because he was a person of great piety, number one, and number two, he probably saw those rulings as being correct. But we rule according to the Shulchan Aruch. And the final thing that I'm going to say is that when he was 17 years old, so signs showed up in the neighborhood of the Bruch Harim saying, Na'ar ba'ar mistoveh bishchunateinu, a wild youth is at loose in our neighborhood. And it was signed by no less than Rabbi Kadir. So we're going to follow the... we're going to follow a little bit of that independence as it travels along its own trajectory. Now, I read an article following Rabbi Yosef's passing by Professor Mark Shapiro. Anyone here know him? So, Professor Mark Shapiro. And he said, Sharon, where is he, Professor?
What is his name?
Scranton. Okay. So, what he had to say was, after describing with due awe Rabbi Yosef's encyclopedic mind, he said, I think what he said is outrageous, and my husband thinks that it's ignorant. Mark Shapiro said, Rabbi Yosef's mind was encyclopedic. He describes the awe, the reverence for Rabbi Yosef. It's unparalleled. And then he says, but there's no halachic creativity. That all he does is put on the scales his predecessors. And he describes how today, when we have search engines, we basically don't need a human encyclopedia any longer. So Rabbi Yosef was a search engine, but he lacks the brilliance of the...
he's probably comparing him to the Sri Deish.
Comparing him to Rabbi Soloveitchik.
No, but he did all his work on the Sri Deish and all those Shuvot and...
I don't...
I mean, I
don't know if that's what goes through his mind, or if what he's thinking of is the brisker pyrotechnics, which can become divorced from reality, and the persona of Rabbi Soloveitchik was commanding. But I sometimes one can have a sense of discomfort with the disconnect from reality that goes on when the processes are intellectual and not necessary and absolutely theoretical. So I think that Mark Shapiro is, as I said, I voiced my opinion, I voiced my husband's opinion. Now, there's something interesting, because there's a tshuva that I brought you last time, and I'm going to bring you today a foil to that tshuva. The tshuva that I brought you last time is number one on this list. Since then, I've been reading volume 10 of Yabia Omer, and especially Eden HaEzer, which I had not read previously, and it's fascinating, it's breathtaking. So in source number one here, Yabia Omer Chelek Aleph, Yerodea Siman Yud Aleph, there's a tshuva from 46, which came from Cairo. We read this last time. Rabbi Yosef was asked about the wine which is touched, which was touched by a non-Sabbath observer. Now, there's a concept of something called, there's yein akum, wine which was libated to idolatry, and there's something called stam yeinam, which is wine touched by a non-Jew or by a Jew who is considered an apostate. Now, there are those who rule that someone who violates the Shabbat is considered an apostate. Rabbi Yosef came, and you're going to see in a moment the foil to this, but Rabbi Yosef came and he asserted as follows. We're not going to read the first tshuva. I'm just going to summarize it. This was after the Muntkacher. Rebbe said there's no such thing in learned tshuvot. He said there's no such thing as someone who violates Shabbat partly. Either you're keeping Shabbat or you're not keeping Shabbat. And you cannot be lenient about the wine of someone who is not a Sabbath observer. And Rabbi Yosef said, that's nonsense. He said as follows, I know here in Cairo, Jews who get up on Shabbat morning to go to the first minyan before they go to work. Can you say that such a Jew is an apostate? Someone who makes Kiddush. And you know, I compared this last time to Sfaradim that I used to see, Moroccans who would, after shul on Shabbat morning, they would go to the ball game, they would go to the soccer game. You go to shul or you make Kiddush. What do you say in Kiddush? You say, Zecher Maaseh Bereishit. You say, commemoration of the creation of the world. Says Rabbi Yosef, A, that is not a heretic. Someone who recognizes God as creator simply by making Kiddush, doesn't matter what else he does on Shabbos, you can't call him a heretic, and you can't say that his wine is like the wine of a heretic. That's absurd. Number two, he says, a Jew who doesn't keep all of the mitzvot will nonetheless be called to account for the mitzvot that he doesn't keep. So you're going to achieve more by pushing him away than you will by drawing him in close? Okay, keep that in mind as background to what we're going to read now. The following, source number two, the following question came in 1989 from a Beit Din in Johannesburg. It's in Eben HaEzer Siman Zayin Chelek Chet. Gimel Shvat Tashmat, that's 1989. לכבוד מרן הגאון הגדול מעוז ומגדול רבן של ישראל הראשון ציון מורנו הרב עובדיה יוסף שליטה. To Rabbi Yosef, the great genius and sage. אחר דרישת שלמה הטוב כראוי, after proper greeting. That's the beginning of a rabbinic address. Bemshech li dvarav shachaver beit inenu ha'av ha'gaon Rabbi Moshe Kortzak shlita sheheitzik lifnei hadrat gaono shlita. Now they're putting into writing what they have spoken about to him orally. So he knows the case. They've spoken about it orally and they're now writing it down. I'm going to summarize the case. So what I found fascinating is that the full name of all parties is written. I decided to delete it because I just felt it wasn't proper for us to be discussing these people, and who knows whether someone here knows one of these people. The witness, I know someone from Vancouver by the same name as the witness testified in Los Angeles. So I don't know whether I know or do not know any of the parties involved. In any event, this came before the Beit Din in South Africa in 1989. I'm first going to summarize it. There was a woman named Bela who was married in a first marriage, which was a halachic marriage. And she was married to, what was his name? She was married to someone named Louis such and such, and his full name is given. In fact, I remember it as I'm speaking. So Bela was married to Louis in South Africa in a halachic marriage. She didn't get a divorce. She didn't get a get. She got a civil divorce, and then she remarried. She had a son from the second marriage, and his name is Mem. He's going to be noted here by the initial Mem. His younger siblings are kosher because the get was given before the younger siblings were born, but he was born before the get. He was born after the civil divorce, before the religious divorce, and now he wishes to marry. And the Beit Din in South Africa, the Beit Din in South Africa did not feel itself able to act. The problem is obviously what? If the woman is considered still married to the first husband, because a get has not been given, then the child is a monster. So that's the question that this Rabbi Kurtzberg is asking.
Today you'd ask, is the bride-to-be a mamzer?
I read another tshuva from volume Yud. I was reading last night when I couldn't sleep on the red eye. So I was reading about someone who grew up in Eilat, whose family is from Eilat. She left home very early and was put into a residential facility which she ran away from. She ran away to Tel Aviv as a teenager. And someone picked her up on the street and offered her a place to sleep, and they slept together. And after a couple of days, she was back on the street, and some other guy picked her up, and she slept with him. And this kept happening until eventually she met somebody named Derry, whom she wanted to marry, and she didn't tell this Derry that she was pregnant. She and this Derry fellow wanted to marry, and they went south to Eilat, where her family was, and her mother blanched when she saw Derry, because he had been married to this person's sister. Her name was Kochava, and Derry had been married to Kochava's sister. But Kochava was already pregnant from this Derry. However,
It
doesn't matter.
Which one is Kochava, the girl in Tel Aviv, or Kochava's sister?
The girl in Tel Aviv.
And Kochava's pregnant, but not from Derry. She's pregnant from one of the previous men.
But she tells Derry it's from him.
I see, okay.
And now she and Derry are prohibited from marrying each other. This daughter is called Ilana. Rabbi Yosef figured out a way to let Ilana marry. It's amazing to see how you have somebody whose heart breaks at the thought of someone whose life is filled with travail. And instead of looking at this person and saying, this is a slut, he wants to help her. So I bring you back to this. You know, you're dealing with people with tough life stories. So I'm bringing you back. This is a little expurgated compared to the other tshuva. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So in the introduction, Rabbi Yosef says, I'm sorry, the question comes, as I told you, that the Bachur Mem, She'alav Medubar, HaBachur Rotze Lisa Yishak She'ra Bat Yisrael, Kedat Moshe Yisrael, the young man wishes to marry, V'anu Lo Matzam Yadenu Baragleinu Kedei La'azor Lo, and we haven't found a way to help him, says the Beit Din in Johannesburg, V'lachein Hechlit Lavo Ba'atzmo El Ma'alat Kvo Torato Be'eretz Yisrael, and that's why he's coming with this letter to you in Eretz Yisrael. In other words, this young man, Mem, is, I came to Israel in order to meet with Rabbi Yosef, she'ulay yimtza pitaron nafsho ha'aluva la'atiro lavo b'kan Hashem. Perhaps you can find a way to permit him to marry into the community of Israel. B'shem Beit Hadin Johannesburg, Baruch Rappaport, Chaver Beit Hadin.
Tshuva. So this is Ashkenazim asking.
Yeah.
The point being, they figure that if anybody's going to be
if anyone's going to be able to answer,
so
it's going to be him.
Matter as far as the Ashkenaz.
No. Yes. Okay. Bidvar hasheila sheshalchu li mitam Beit Hadin Johannesburg, elai odot habuchur mem. Regarding the question which you, the Beit Din in Johannesburg, have sent me regarding the young man Mem. Asher imo Bela Levet Samach Nis'al HaRishana B'Kupa V'Kiddushin V'Yehudim Shem Louis Reish, whose mother Bela from the family of Samach, the family of S, initially married with a proper chupa and marriage ceremony, a Jew named Louis R. B'Tisha B'Yanuar Shnat 45 L'Minyanam, she got married in 45. V'nifreda mimenu b'perud ezrachi al yidei ha'erkaot bilvad. She separated only by means of a civil court. V'chazra v'niseit la'arye lamed etza ha'reformim b'shneimasar la'april 59 l'minyanam. She had a reform ceremony where she obviously was not asked regarding the status of her get. V'nolad lahem ha'ben mem b'tarich 22 l'mer shnat 60. And in 1960, the son was born. V'achar kach l'achar ma'amatz kibla ha'geret Bela get piturim k'dat Moshe v'Yisrael mi'ba'ala ha'rishon b'arvasa v'December 60. And he was born on the 29th of March, 1960. And on the in December, she got her get. Ulefize, the following December, Ulefize Kayemet Shelach Mamzerut Etzal Ben Hanal HaBal HaRishon Faritar. The first husband is already dead. That's going to become germane for something. And there is a question of Mamzerut. V'inei Achar HaChakira V'adrisha Shel Beit Hadin Hitbarer. And now Rabbi Yosef is summarizing the details that came to him. And he says, the investigation of the Beit Din proved שהנישואים הראשונים של האישה בלה לבית סמה התקיימו בבית כנסת אורתודוקסי ביוהנסבורג על ידי הרב אלף אלטשולר זל שהיה רב אורתודוקסי אולם מתוך עדי. So the ceremony was in a halachic congregation by means of Rabbi Altshuler. אולם מתוך עדי הקידושים שמתייחדו לכך על ידי הרב, but the witnesses who were appointed by the rabbi, אחד מהם היה אייב סמך. One of them was אייב S, שהוא אחיה של הקלה בלה, who is the brother of the kala.
And the best thing didn't know that?
And what?
The based in Johannesburg didn't know?
You know what? I asked myself that until this morning I looked up the Rambam and I discovered something. There's something called Rishon L'Rishon, Sheni L'Sheni, Shlishi L'Shlishi, Rishon L'Shlishi. Who is Psul Edim? the pasuk in Dvarim says, the pasuk in Dvarim says, "Lo yumtu avot al banim." Fathers shall not be put to death for their sons. The pshat of the pasuk is that there will not be collective punishment. You punish each person for their own sin. You do not punish a father for the sin of his son. But Chazal have a drasha on that pasuk, and the drasha is Lo yumtu avot al pi edut banim, that fathers cannot be put to death by means of the testimony of their sons. Do you hear the difference between the pshat and between the drasha? According to the pshat, fathers will not be put to death for the sins of their sons. According to the drasha, fathers will not be put to death by the testimony of their sons. Now, from this we learn that the testimony of a relative is inadmissible, and relatives are classed in according to degrees of relationship. Brothers will be called Rishon Berishon, or father and son would be called Rishon Berishon.
But not brother and sister?
Well, it says Lo yumtu avot al banim, so there's a machloket whether it's only relationships through the father. And this Abe was related, was a brother through the mother. So why did the rabbi not notice that? I'll get to Sheni the Sheni in a little while, but why did the rabbi not notice? Because she had a different last name.
He didn't ask, though? A rabbi doesn't ask. Today
they all ask the Adam. That's one of the first questions.
Exactly. It's so basic that they ask, is there any relationship between?
Okay, Wendy, you can be a rabbi now.
At every wedding that I know, asked the.
But this rabbi didn't, and she had a different. She had a different name. Obviously, the older brother, who was a brother through the mother. The mother had remarried. So let's say her name was previously Cohen. Her name is now Levi.
Right.
The rabbi didn't make the connection.
Is there a concept in Jewish law about the relationship being less of a relationship when it's not for both parents? This half-sister, half-brother?
Regarding Eidut, the halachic, in general, the answer is no. In general, the answer is no. But regarding Eidut, the answer is you have that pasuk lo yumtu avot al banim. So there is a daya that it is only midrabanan, it is only rabbinically prohibited. There are those who feel it's biblically prohibited and those who feel it's rabbinically prohibited to have a witness who has a blood relationship through the mother. Okay. So we go on. This Abe is today in the United States. And he is the great uncle of Mem. In other words, Bela's son is Mem. Let's call him Matthew. That wasn't his name, but let's call him Matthew. Bela has a son named Matthew. The witness, one of the two witnesses at his mother's wedding, was his mother's, was Uncle Abe, Matthew's Uncle Abe, Hamvakesh Hanal. V'kanireh sh'arav misaver ha'kiddushin lo yada sh'eid hazeh hu achi ha'shel kala. Apparently, the rabbi who officiated didn't know that this witness was the brother of the bride. U'beit hadin shel Johannesburg gava eidut b'inyan zeh b'zeh ha'lashon. במותב פלטה כחדה הבינה, ובאו לפנינו מר דרומל ומר אוספנגר, והעידו בפנינו שהם זוכרים את החתונה הנעל, ויודעים בראש אחיה של הקלה בלה מר אייב סמך, היה אחד משני עדי קידושים וגם חתם על הכתובה. So, these two individuals, Mr. Dromal and Mr. Olsfanger, came before the Beit Din in South Africa and they said, we remember the wedding and we testify that Abe was one of the witnesses and he was also a signatory on the ketubah. וחתמו על זה שלושת חברי בית הדין ביוהנסבורג, and we have the signatures of the three members of the Beit Din, the court in Johannesburg, that they heard this testimony from these two witnesses, that Abe was a witness at the chuppah. אף העיד אייב סמך הנ"ל הופיע בעצמו בפני בית הדין בלוס אנג'לס. And in fact, Abe went before a court, a בית דין in Los Angeles, והעיד בפניהם שאכן הוא היה עד קידושין בזמנו בנישואי אחותו בלה הנ"ל. And Abe himself went before בית דין in Los Angeles, and he said, I indeed testified at the wedding. Okay. Now, נראה... אלף, נראה לפי עניות דעתי שבחלק היוצא בזה בטלו הקידושין מפגיע. Therefore, it seems to me that the קידושין are retroactively invalid. כדקיימלן עדות שבטלה מקצתה בטלה כולה. Now he is bringing a שיטה of מהריב ויל. מהריב ויל was... one of two preeminent halachic authorities in Germany in the 15th century, and Maharif Weil, and you're going to see what Rav Ovadia is doing. He's going to bring a whole list of people who agree with Maharif Weil, and then he's going to mention that there are those who disagree. But he's going to first bring support for the position of Maharif Weil. Mark Shapiro is looking for the, I guess, Talmudic casuistry. And you don't know what's going on in Rav Ovadia's mind. You do know that he has decided this is right, and he has decided he's helping somebody, and he's going to do it. So he brings the shita of Maharif Weil that when a testimony is when a testimony is rendered partly invalid, it is wholly invalid. Now, not everyone agrees with that. You're getting to the question of testimony. What constitutes testimony? Let's assume there's a crime which is committed. The crime can be assault. The crime can be murder. If there are witnesses who witnessed, those witnesses go to a Beit Din and they say, I saw Reuven murder Shimon. That testimony will be admitted. But there's another kind of testimony, not testimony in which someone is testifying that they saw something, that they witnessed, but rather testimony which is required in order to make a particular procedure valid. A wedding ceremony will not be valid without witnesses, and for that there are authorities who hold, and Rabbi Yosef holds that, that witnesses must be appointed. Under the chuppah, you will frequently hear the rabbi say to the chatan, appoint these witnesses. Do you appoint these witnesses to be your exclusive witnesses? And the chatan will say, atem edai, you are my witnesses, and no one else is a witness. And by means of that, you have excluded few people. Now, you can't do that during a crime. You can't exclude someone from seeing what they have seen. But when you have the kind of testimony which is rendering a ceremony valid or rendering a transaction valid, you can appoint specific witnesses to that ceremony. So Rabbi Yosef brings the shita of Maharif Weil that... if part of the testimony is invalid, the testimony is valid. Invalid. וכמו שהעליתי בסלקדתך בכמה תשובות, שמכיוון שמסדר הקידושין ייחד עדי קידושין, ונמצא אחד מהם קרוב, הקידושין בטלים. As I have stated several times, since the officiating rabbi appointed witnesses, and one of them is found to be a relative, the ceremony is invalid, ואין מסדר הקידושין עצמו מצטרף עם העד אחד בקיום הקידושין, and the rabbi himself does not become a witness. I mean, you could say, hold it, okay, so Abe was an invalid witness, but we have another Jew who was there who was a kosher witness, and that's the rabbi. But what? The rabbi does not become a witness, shemayachar sheyichay datei dei pivushim, since the rabbi appointed witnesses, hotziyat atzmo miliyot eid. He excluded himself from being a witness. V'chein kol she'ar ha'am she'uz menu li'ishtatek v'azmunei chatan v'kala, enam yicholim li'itztarek v'aidut ha'kidushin. And likewise, all the rest of the people who were appointed to celebrate with the couple, they cannot be considered witnesses. U'kuma she'katav ben Yaakov Vad v'shut Mahariv. Now he's quoting where he got this from Maharival, Shaham Yached Eidim Kiddushim Edim Su'upsulim, Sheyu Haidim Krovim Zelezeh Sheni B'Sheni. Maharival mentions, when you have witnesses who are Sheni B'Sheni, now I mentioned what Rishon B'Rishon is, there's Rishon B'Sheni, Sheni B'Sheni, and there's Shlishi, there's Shlishi B'Shlishi, Rishon B'Rishon is the siblings. Sheni b'sheni is cousins, or these are all invalid. Shlishi b'rishon is valid. So he says, Maharival mentions that Sheni v'sheni invalidates the marriage. Pshita de lo havu kiddushin klal, afa pisha kiddushin nasu b'fnei hamon am. Even though the marital ceremony was before a huge congregation, it is not a valid ceremony. Even though hayusham harbe anashim haksherim leidut, even though there were many kosher witnesses there, mikevan shi yichadu eidim l'kach. But since they appointed witnesses, kavanatam hayta sharak ha'edim sheyichadu yiyu edim al ha'kiddushin. Their intent was only that these witnesses be witnesses, v'lo she'ar ha'am, v'shekein mukhach b'harosh, v'kol shekein v'fi perush rashbam, she'im kivein ha'psul l'ha'id posel, she'im kivein ha'psul l'ha'id, that if the Rashbam says, if someone who is an invalid witness intended to testify, posel hu et kol ha'edut, he invalidates the whole testimony, shebevaday ein kan kiddushim u'tzrichim kiddushim achirim, ad kan. This was a quote from the Rosh. V'chein huva tshuva zo b'shut Mahari Bruna. Now he's quoting Mahari Bruna. Bruna is in Germany, again, 15th century. We're now at the end of the 15th century. Some of you may have been in Zurich in a minyan called Brunau, that comes from the Kehila that came from Brunau, Germany. Masha Katav Pshita Dlo Havu Kiddushin Muchach Lahadya She'enat Zricha Get Klav. From the fact that Marie Bruna says that there were no kiddushin, it is clear that she does not need a get. V'chein katav bishmo ha'kneset ha'gdola, that's Ben Vedisti, 17th century Turkey. V'chein bishut maharibal, v'dat maharib, and Marie Ben Lev, 16th century Salonika. Explains, even though he differs with the position, you can, if you don't look up Shuf Maharibal, you might think that Maharibal agrees with the position. He simply is explicating the position of Maharibal that he disagrees with. V'chein b'shut Maharshat, Chelek Aleph Pasak, She'im yichadu edim u'matzu psulim l'chule alma עדות כולם בתהילה, וכתב שסברה זו קיים בנפשי, and מהרשך, and I don't remember who מהרשך is. He is Rav Shlomo Kohen of Salonika. He too says, he's one of the early Achronim, he too says that if they appointed Eidim and they were disqualified, then the entirety of the testimony is invalid. And Maharshach wrote, "V'katav shesvarazo kiyem nafshei." This was his own reasoning. V'shuv matzakein l'Mahariv, and he found it in Maharif Vayel. V'samach le'shekivein l'dat tozal, and Maharshach was delighted to discover that his svara was found in Maharif Vayel sheyesh l'damot hazmana v'yichud ha'edim hapsulim v'vitul edut hakshirim hanimtzaim sham. לדין הזמנת וייחוד עדים קשרים שאין הפסולים מצטרפים לעדות לבטל עדותם. And he says that when you appoint disqualified עדים, it is not the same as when you appoint qualified witnesses, and there happen to be disqualified witnesses also, that then we don't nullify the testimony. But here you've appointed disqualified witnesses. V'chein da'at maharimat, that's Rabbi Yosef Detrani, 17th century Tzfat, Turkey, and then Tzfat, Bechidushav al Harif, Vehuva Beshut Orli. Most people do not know who these people are. Or Shut Orli, I have never heard of it. Rabbi Yosef read everything. He read everything. I think I understand a little bit of this, just a little bit of this from my husband, who would read, you put a Kellogg's cornflakes box in front of him, he's going to read it. Just, if it has letters on it, he's going to read it. Rabbi Yosef read everything. He is hunting up every opinion who sides with Maharif Vayel. V'chein b'shut rosh mashbir. The previous ones I mentioned are known, but shedivrei ha-Maharif bazeh, שדברי המעריב בזה דברי אלוקים חיים וכבר הסכימו לדבריו אשלי רב רבי סרחין תלטה הלוהם פשוט פרח מתה אהרון חלק בית ופשוט נאמן שמואל ופשוט קרם שלמה עיין שם ומי הם אלה should not be written there. Those were my words. I was looking, I wrote that as a note to myself to find out who they were. וכן כתב בשוט באר מים חיים מוצרי בשם הנאמן שמואל ושלא מצאנו שום חולק על דברי המעריב הנעל. And the נאמן שמואל tells us that no one disagrees with מעריב איל. ודבריו, דברי המעריב נכוחים למבין וישרים למוצאי דעת. וידוע שהרב נאמן שמואל היה מפורסם לרב גדול ומומחה מאוד בהוראה ופגש בי עד עיין שם. That's a close quote from Shut Be'er Mayim Chaim, who says, the Neaman Shmuel says, nobody disagreed with Maharif Vayel. Maharif Vayel's position is, if part of the testimony is proclaimed invalid, the testimony is invalid, and if there is an invalid witness to a chuppah, who has been appointed a witness, the chuppah has not taken place, and says Neaman Shmuel, and nobody disagrees. And says Be'er Mayim Chayim Mutzari that nobody disagrees with Maharif Vayel. Well, that's not so. Ayin Sham. V'af al pi shematzanu. Now Rabbi Yosef is saying, and even though we found La Maharif Vayel, I'm going to tell you in a moment about Maharif Vayel. Chelek Aleph shekatav lefak peik al divrei Maharif Hanal. And even though we found Maharif Vayel objected to Maharif Vayel, in other words, we've heard no one disagrees with Maharif Vayel, says Rabbi Yosef, that's not so. Maharif Vayel disagrees with him. Let me tell you about Maharif Vayel. Maharif Vayel lived, Maharif Vayel is Maharif Ben Lev. He lived in Turkey in the 16th century. He was an individual, he was strong-minded. He was one of the great sages of Sephardi Jewry, and he objected to the Beit Yosef. He objected to the codification of the Shulchan Aruch. Before the Shulchan Aruch was written, Rabbi Yosef Karo wrote a commentary on the Torah, giving the sources for the Torah. Mahari Baal objected so strenuously to Beit Yosef that he prohibited his students from reading it because he thought it was like art scroll. He thought that what the Beit Yosef was doing, the Torah didn't give his sources. The Beit Yosef came, Rabbi Yosef Karo, he did this with the Rambam, he did this with the Torah, he brought all of their sources. In other words, they wrote books which they assumed were, which they meant to be codifications, and therefore they didn't give their sources because they were giving their ruling. Comes Rabbi Yosef Karo, and he wrote what all the sources were for the Torah and for the Rambam. And Mahari Baal was furious with him because he felt that what he was doing was limiting scholarship. He felt that if you're a proper scholar, you don't need the cliff notes. And he felt that by giving the sources, he was preventing proper study of the Torah, and the way to study it is you need to know. You need to know what the Torah sources are. You're not supposed to have the annotated edition.
They studied the Torah before that by finding out their sources, or they just took it point blank for what it was?
Well, it depends who they were.
No, they had any books.
It depends. It depends who they were.
Yeah.
And if you're dealing with Ma'ariba and Lev, the answer is no. You go back to the Gemara. You need to know where he's bringing from. You need to discuss the argument itself. And you don't want to have the cliff notes. To the extent, he was a strong-minded individual. He lost one of his sons who was murdered by a hired, not a hired gun. What were you hired? What implement of murder were you hired? A hired knife? He ruled against the wealthiest man in the community. And this wealthiest man in the community was annoyed at him. And he hired someone to put Mahari Baal's son to death in order to try to limit Mahari Baal's, to shut his mouth. He didn't. He didn't. He succeeded in killing the son. Yeah. Mahari Baal lost. Pardon me? Well, he started out in. He was in Constantinople for a while. He moved from one place to another after the loss of his son. Not immediately, but he eventually migrated to Constantinople. He started out, I didn't note it down. I don't remember where, but in... elsewhere in Turkey. So Mahari Baal disagreed with Mahari Baal about the cancellation of the nullification of a wedding. That if you nullify one, if you pronounce one witness disqualified, that you're going to nullify the ceremony. And Rabbi Yosef says, "V'afal pisha matzanu l'Mahari Baal chelak alef shekatav l'fakpek al divrei Mahari hanav v'katav she'en lismoch hazel l'fotra b'lo get ayen shak." And even though we find Mahari Baal wrote questioning the reasoning of Mahari Baal and ruling that you can't rely upon Mahari Baal in order to free someone from a get. ועיין עוד בשוט חוות יאיר ובאבני מילואים ובקצות החושב ובשוט חתם סופר עיין שם. My husband comments in one of his tshuvot that when Rabbi Yosef says Ayin Od, you don't know what side they're taking in the controversy. You need to go back. He doesn't do your homework for you. In this case, he sends you to the Chavat Yair, and the Chavat Yair rules against the way Rabbi Yosef wishes to rule. So he just mentions them. He mentions them.
He lets you know that he knows.
Yeah, because otherwise you're likely to get up and to say, well, the Chavat Yair says otherwise. Mikol makom nireh lefi aniyut da'ati she'ikar kedivei ha'ma'ariv v'siyato. In any event, it seems, in my humble opinion, that the essence is as Maharib Vayil, and all those who agree with him rule. Ukvar herachti b'zeh b'siyata d'shmaya le'el u'misham be'era. And I have already discussed this elsewhere at length. So that's paragraph one of his tshuva. You can rely upon Maharib Vayil in order to disqualify. That witness is disqualified. That witness, Abe, is disqualified. You can rely upon Maharib Vayil against the others in order to annul the ceremony retroactively.
So,
yes.
So the part, the Maharib Vayil said that if you disqualify the testimony in part, you disqualify the entire testimony. I mean, the part here is one witness, and the whole is everybody else's testimony. Right.
The other witness's testimony, because what Rabbi Yosef has said here is that once you appoint witnesses to testify, you exclude everybody else from testifying. By appointing for ceremonial purposes two specific witnesses, they are the only witnesses.
So then why do you need the Maharib Vayil at all? Because they're not witnesses anymore.
Well, Maharib Vayil is, because you're dealing with Mamzerut, because you're dealing with something which is so severe and so stringent, and you'll see in just a moment what Rabbi Yosef does in the next paragraph, he's saying that maybe we're going to say, well, she still needs a get based upon the testimony of one kosher witness.
Because you will see that it says that even though you may have these witnesses, maybe the other witness perhaps.
The other witness is still okay.
Okay.
Okay, let's take care of the other witness. We've taken care of one. And regarding the other witness, remember the tshuva about the wine of someone who is not observant?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now look. Ulam v'nidon didan. But in our matter, it seems to me anyway that one needs to rule leniently, even without Maharib Vayil. Kinodal beit hadin hanal shehaed hasheni shal hakidushin mylev hu rofei einayim meforsam beYohannesburg. The second witness is a well-known ophthalmologist in Johannesburg. V'yadua shehu oved b'miktzaot gam b'Shabbat. And it's known that he works on Shabbat. Now, you remember what he wrote previously about those who work on Shabbat. He wrote previously that those who work on Shabbat, do they make Kiddush? If they make Kiddush, you cannot call
them.
You can't write them off. Okay. But that was about Kiddush.
Yes, right.
And this is about somebody who needs to get married. So he says, V'yadur shehu oved b'mitzo'o gam b'Shabbat. It is known that this ophthalmologist, Mr. Leib, works on Shabbat. V'noheg b'mechonito b'Shabbat, k'min hago b'chol, and he rides on Shabbat. Where does he ride to?
How did the Orthodox shul, though, accept him as a witness to begin with? That's the point. He was so careful to say that it was an Orthodox rabbi, an Orthodox...
Because
there are... Too careful, Wendy. I mean, sure.
Because there are communities around the world where someone may belong to an Orthodox shul, and that doesn't mean that all of their practices are necessarily Orthodox. But it simply says he rides on Shabbat as he rides during the week. Now, where does he ride to on Shabbat? Is it possible that he rides to the hospital?
Yeah.
But we're not dealing with that. He has been seen riding on Shabbat. That's what's important right now. V'eino shomer mitzvot klal, and he doesn't observe mitzvot at all. וגם הוא אישר שהיה עד הקידושין בנישואים הנ"ל, and he also affirmed, obviously, he was an important person, he was given a role in the ceremony because he's an important person.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Chana, but it sounds like what he's really done here more than a halachic analysis is he's been a private investigator to find out all these details, or did the court in South Africa tell him all these details?
The court told him those details.
In
other words, he asked the right questions in order to collect the information. But what he's doing here is he's saying the same way that he said regarding the Ben Ish Chai, and we don't rule that way, as a 17-year-old, as a senior in high school, which wasn't it, but as a senior in a fictitious high school, or in the yeshiva that he was in, he looked at it and he said, and this is the statement of great piety, and we don't rule that way. And as I said, there's a concern here about embracing all Israel. I'm going to go 5 minutes till 5 minutes after 11. I hope everybody can stay here to get to the end of this and also to have me summarize the next tshuva. וחתם על הכתובה ונמצא שגם העית השני פסול מחמת עבירה אלא שלא נתקבלה עליו עדות בפניו בפסלו. However, testimony was not given to disqualify him before him, and we have a rule in halakha, or we have an opinion, that in order to disqualify a witness, you need to testify before that witness, because you're impugning the person's reputation. By saying the person is disqualified, you are saying either that that person is a seedy character who is engaged in inappropriate, well, you're saying this is a person who is engaged in inappropriate behavior. So there is, so Rabbi Yosef says, and it is known that he is disqualified. However, there was no testimony before him. And therefore, what I can do is it's called snifim lahatir. I can combine. This is a somewhat weak argument because he wasn't disqualified before.
At the time.
It's not the same thing as a blood relationship, where this Abe testified in Los Angeles saying, I'm the brother of the Kala and I testified at the wedding. But here you're dealing with someone who witnessed, who signed that he witnessed, but the problem was that he was seen riding on Shabbat and he does not follow mitzvot. But there was no testimony before him. But you can combine that. Ulahamit ha'isha b'cheskat knuya, and you can announce, you can consider the woman to have been unmarried. Mikomakom b'nidan didan yeshan sfeik sfeika l'hakel. We have what's called a sfeik sfeika. We have two doubts. We have a doubt. We're not sure that the he's going to explain this fake sfeika. One doubt piled on another. Shema hakidushin psulim biglal idut achiha shel hakala. Perhaps the ceremony is invalid because of the testimony of the brother of the bride. Veidut shebatla miktzata batla kula vaafilu im tirtze lomar shetitkayem haidut beid hasheni sheino karov lachatan vakala shema halakha ka'omrim she'ein tzrich kabel eidut pisula lufanav. If you wish to rule according to those who say that if you wish to say that the ceremony is considered valid because of the testimony of the other witness, perhaps the halakha is that because perhaps the halakha is perhaps the halakha is that you don't need to disqualify a witness before him in his face. So you have two perhapses. V'shema cheskat pnuya mo'ila gam b'sfeika d'dina. V'od v'nidan d'idan. Now, this is what I wanted everyone to see. And in addition, in our case, Einanu donim lahavkia hakidushin beisur eshet ish leteira la'alma. We are not dealing with permitting the woman to remarry. Permitting the woman to remarry without a get is a matter of what? Eshet ish. The woman is considered married to Reuven, and you're permitting her to marry Shimon. We're not dealing with permitting the woman to remarry. Elarak ilinyan isur mamserut. We're only dealing with mamserut. What's the difference between mamserut and eshet ish? Eshet ish is karet. Eshet ish is punishable by severing from the Jewish people, and it is a capital crime. Mamzerut is not capital. Marrying a mamzer is not capital. And therefore he says, Shehu isur lav, it is prohibited from the Torah. Umin ha-Torah ein isur mamzerut, ela bi-isur vadai, velo bi-isur safi. From the Torah, a mamzer is only someone, the prohibition against marrying a mamzer is someone who is a known, a certain mamzer. But in this case, we have a safek, we have a doubt. Ukedamin and bekidushin lo yavo mamzer bekal Hashem. The Gemara in Kiddushin says, mamzer vaday hu lo yavo. Has safek mamzer yavo. If someone is perhaps a mamzer, we don't have that prohibition. Ela demala subiyufosin. He shouldn't marry a kohen. He's not considered of great genealogy. וכשיש לנו כמה ספקות להכר בוודאי יש להתיר גם בפסול יוחסין. And if we have several doubts, we certainly need to permit in matters of יוחסין, in matters of genealogy, אפילו בתי ספקי. There are those who say you need three doubts in order to permit. He says you permit with two doubts. It's clear you have questionable validity to the ceremony here, you have questionable validity here, you can rely upon that. And a mamzer, sach hakol, is only an isur lav, is only prohibited from the Torah, but it is not a capital crime. Marrying a mamzer is not a capital crime, and therefore he says you can. And he's a safek mamzer, and therefore there's no isur from the Torah, and therefore you can rule in his behavior, in his favor. And he ends the next line, maskana dedina shembakesh, shehamvakesh, but his whole name is written here, memsher kasher lavo bekal Hashem. It is important to write his name, and I was thinking this afterwards, because afterwards, one might wish to marry the child of this Matthew, or the grandchild of this Matthew. Well, he is kosher to marry v'laseit isha k'dat Moshe v'Yisrael, v'yizkeh lakim bayit ne'man v'Yisrael, and may he establish a faithful home in Israel. There are not tens of tshuvot of this sort of Rabbi Yosef. There are hundreds of tshuvot of this sort, Rabbi Yosef. Each one with its own individual permutations, each one with its own reasoning, and each one seeking to find a way within halakha that can be inclusive of everyone. I want to mention one other thing. I'm not going to read the tshuva. Next year is Shemitah. Mm-hmm. In, you know that the Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael started in the 1880s? Well, the first Shemitah afterwards was not a problem because there were too few people who were farmers, and they were all being, they could be supported by philanthropists from abroad. But when you got to 1889, you already had enough farmers that Shemitah became an issue. And that was when Rabbi Shmuel Mulliver enlisted Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector of Kovna to issue the Heter Mechira. Rav Cook in the 30s relied upon the Heter Mechira. The Heter Mechira is that farmers sign to appoint the chief rabbinate their it's either to appoint the chief rabbinate their shaliach or probably this time they will directly, it will be directly performed for them. Their land is sold to a non-Jew. The sale of land to a non-Jew in Israel is questionable. The use of the Heter Mechira reminds you all of what? Mechiras Chametz. It reminds you all of Pesach. It's called in Hebrew Ha'arama, circumventing the law. And the question is circumventing the law for the purpose of upholding the law considered appropriate or not considered appropriate? And it has been ruled in the case of Mechirat Chametz, it has been ruled in other cases as being appropriate, although it is a matter of, it is questionable and it is used. Mm-hmm. The Heter Mechirat separates, it's the fault line in Israel. I always feel when you approach Shemitah that you're looking at one agricultural, one sector of the economy, and you're expecting that one sector to observe Shemitah, while lawyers can keep earning their income, and doctors can keep earning their income, and investment bankers can keep investing, and the only people who are carrying the responsibility are the farmers. So I just read two lines out of Rav Cook and a little bit of Yabia Omer, and we'll end, Rabbi Yosef will end there. Rav Cook's reasoning in okaying the Heter Mechira was that the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael will collapse without it. That the Yishuv is so poor, the farmers are so indigent, that this is their life, not just their livelihood, but their life. If you look at the first paragraph, from the first ellipsis, Vaday yesh lanu nimsa, this is in source 3, of Mishpat Kohen of Rav Kook. Vaday yesh lanu nimsmoch al heter ha-mechira bimkom ha-dachat ha-ayom sha-yishuv sharui bo. Certainly, we can rely upon the sale of the land in the place of the extreme poverty that the community in Israel is found within. L'dati shabchal makom shenimtza minismoch b'dachas matzum v'norah kazeh mitzvah lismoch l'hakel. It seems to me, says Rabbi Cook, that wherever we can, we have upon whom to rely in situations of extreme poverty, we can rely. Rabbi Yosef says something totally different. Take a look at what his consideration is. It's no longer extreme poverty, because thank God, when he was writing, we weren't dealing any longer with extreme poverty. But he had another consideration. It is clear that we need to rely, that we can rely, that Shemitah today is a rabbinic ruling. Al heter ha-mechira shenasa bizmano al pi hora'at gedolim chikrei lev. We can rely upon the heter mechira that was legislated by the greats in their time. Even though the reasons that existed in their time were more grave, in other words, there was poverty. Nevertheless, we know that hundreds of farmers, their livelihood is only from farming. And we know that they have no other means of support other than farming. They have no choice but to rely upon the Heter Mechira. Now I'm skipping to the next paragraph.
Al Hashem Torah.
לא שב כי התרע ואחלה איסורה, וגם הם באים על הרבנות הראשית לחתום ההרשאות למחירת קרקעותיהם רכי. And even those farmers who are not observant, they nevertheless come to the rabbinate in order to sign to sell their lands. ואילו לא הייתה הרבנות הראשית נתפלת בהם לקבל אותם ואת חמיתמתם להרשאה. And if the rabbanut rashit did not sign them up to permit למחירת הקרקע שלהם, to permit them to sell their lands, היו עושים הכל ביסור. They would still farm, violating Shemitah כדרכם בכל השנים, just as they do all years, והיו עובדים בעצמם בשדותיהם, they would work their fields, בלי בחירה, והיו מפיקסים את מרכולתם בכל הארץ, ומכשירים מהם את האנשים התמימים, באיסור ספיחים, באיסור ספורה, and they would sell their agricultural output, and people would eat of it, and people would violate the law. ועל ידי המחירה לנחי, הם מצילים את רוב ההמון בית ישראל מלהיכשל באיסור שביעית. And by means of היתר מחירה, we're saving most of the country from שביעית, from violating Shemitah. It's a fault line in Israeli society. It's a fault line because, it's like I said at the beginning, are you concerned with the 500 Talmidim, or are you concerned with those two who have a chance to become greats? Are you concerned with your own small community, or are you concerned with the entirety of the nation? And if you were not to have the Heter Mechira, you would not be permitted, according to the laws of Shemitah, to export Peirot Shvi'it to Chutz Laaretz. What about your export markets? You would get them back a year later? So it's very interesting because Rabbi Feinstein ruled that you could buy etrogim, Shemitah etrogim, in Chutz Laaretz, which if you were not relying upon Heter Mechira, you couldn't do that. Rabbi Feinstein ruled you could. Rabbi Soloveitchik ruled you couldn't. Rabbi Feinstein ruled you could because he said, the people who signed the Heter Mechira are relying upon rabbis. In other words, they're not acting against halacha. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Soloveitchik said you couldn't because he was going back to that reasoning of dochat gadol, of absolute indigence, and he said we're not indigent in the United States and therefore we shouldn't buy. So it's very interesting to see, but I think what one sees, if I could sum up everything we said in these two classes, is what you see in Rabbi Yosef that I think should be a motto, is a concern for the community, is an unwillingness to write people off. And even if one time you have to argue this way, and the other time you have to argue that way, you do it. Why? Because the bottom line has to do with an ethic of holding the people together. It has to do with an ethic of helping people, of meeting people's needs, and of not letting people suffer. If you can find any way of preventing that, and that's whether the people who are potentially suffering are farmers or the people who are potentially suffering are those whose parents committed inappropriate deeds. So for me, this is very inspiring, and I hope it has been thus for you.
So I hope everybody will come to the dining room and have some good food.
Oh yes, and I wish everyone